Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You are listening to Inside F1 with Joe Sayward on Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners-Reddy, and I bring you the expertise of someone who has been to every Grand Prix as a journalist since 1988. It's Joe Sayward. Hello, Joe.
Hello, how are you?
Some rare time at home for you, Joe, in between quadruple headers.
It is. It's been the last one was very long because I spent the time between Texas and Mexico in the US to see my son, who I hadn't seen for 2.5 years.
Oh, wow.
So I was away from home for 5 weeks, and I've been back for 5 days, and I'm going away for another 2 weeks. So yippee-yay.
Yippee-yay, yeah, but I'd never thought I'd hear you saying yippee-yay, so I was temporarily thrown there. So you must
okay.
be a diehard
Well, the
fan.
Other thing is, the other thing is that this the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix is my 600th Grand Prix.
Wow, is that a milestone you will be marking with a celebration?
Probably not, because in Saudi Arabia there's no booze allowed, is there? So I don't suppose we'll be tippling any. Otherwise, we'll be in trouble, I expect.
Oh, you'll have to behave yourself. Was everyone behaving themselves in Qatar? So I guess that's the first time you've covered a race at that venue.
It is, but in Qatar they're not quite as strict on the old booze front. If you stay in the right hotel, by asking someone who works in MotoGP to tell you where to stay, you can get some very nice gin and tonics. And so, yes, I was well sorted in Doha. It's an interesting place. They've got lots of money. What they're doing is amazing. What they're doing, the building for the World Cup and just in general. I mean, it's, I don't know how to describe it really. It's just like when you're a kid, you know, you design cities and things and, you know, fancy buildings and, that's exactly what they're doing there. You know, it's just like, we'll have an avenue here and the metro station here and we'll have a big palace here. This kind of stuff.
And the track, I mean, we all feared the worst. As soon as you say it's designed for bikes, people go, oh, no. But it wasn't bad at all. In fact, there was some decent racing up and down the field.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. The only thing I'd say is that it doesn't fulfill the role of what a Grand Prix in Doha was supposed to do, which is to promote the idea that Qatar's a place you want to go on holiday.
It didn't?
Because you just saw desert.
Mm.
This is one of the problems with like Bahrain. That's why a night race is always a good idea in the desert, because then you don't see desert, you see night, which is why they've done it in Bahrain and Abu Dhabi as well, because basically desert looks like desert, doesn't it?
Yeah.
However, the long-term plan is to have a street race in Doha when we go back in 2 years' time after the Welt Cup.
Really? Another street race?
Yes, but it'll be a different one. This one will be right down the downtown with all the twisty buildings and the silvery things. And they're trying to make it a sort of mix between Monaco, Baku, and Singapore. And so have good racetrack surrounded by glitzy things with a bit of sea thrown in.
Okay. I mean, you just mentioned like three of probably my bottom three tracks on the calendar, to be fair. I mean, certainly Monaco, Baku can be good.
Baku's extremely good normally.
If there's a crash. If there's a safety car, it's good. If not, it just stagnates, doesn't it?
Baku, you get good racing. No. You always get good racing in Baku. This is because it's got a jolly long straight.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can actually do things. Anyway, the plan is to have a jolly long straight in the middle of Doha.
Okay.
And to have a night race there. And I think you need a night race because it's so very hot in the daytime. So, you know, that's one of the things to look forward to in 2023, because there isn't a race in 2022, because we're all going to watch football, or at least people who like football are going to watch football, and I'm going to watch something else.
I'll watch a bit of it, I guess. Okay, so just as we got to know that track and not hate it, we're going to definitely not have it again, ever. Okay.
As far as I understand it, it's definitely not going to be the same again, but you never know. Maybe the downturn in oil prices will mean that it's all jolly expensive and they'll just tart up the old place, but I think not. I think they've probably got enough cash floating around, or it just keeps coming out the ground there, you know?
Okay, look, well, we're moving on. We're going to Saudi Arabia. A lot of controversy around the track and it being built. And will it be built? Is the track ready? I've seen some pictures. Are we going there? For sure.
Well, there's people already there. So if we're not going there, we're in trouble.
Okay.
The track is built. I'm not suggesting that all the buildings are necessarily finished yet. There might be a few sort of plastic wrap things going on. I don't know, to be honest. I'll let you know when I get there. But the track is all good. I spoke to the Tilkers, father and son, the other day, and they said everything's fine. They got delayed a little bit by, would you believe, rainstorms in Jeddah that set the construction back a little bit. But it, as they also added, it was a good test because we checked out the drainage system. So, and that appears to work. So it's always possible that it will rain on one of these tracks. We have had rain in the past, I think once in Bahrain. Not sure you ever had it in Abu Dhabi, but you know, it's not necessarily just going to be another desert racetrack. But
okay.
This one's by the sea as well, so there's going to be breezes coming off the sea. The difference is, I think that Jeddah doesn't really have a very dramatic. The track looks very dramatic, but there's not much of a skyline or anything like that. But in terms of what they've done, it's absolutely astonishing what they've done. They started work in April, so. April to now is what?
7 months. 7 months. But can you understand some skepticism when it was looking so doubtful, the pictures looked dodgy, and then all of a sudden, no, it's done, everything's fine, come along, everything will be okay?
If you have unlimited money, you can achieve amazing things. And this seems to be the case. Remember, they're only building Jeddah in theory for two or three races. They're going to build a whole new motorsport city outside Riyadh.
Oh.
With all singing, all dancing, and, you know, sort of waterfalls going over the racetrack and whirly birds, and who knows what they're going to do, but that's the plan. So this is just a stopgap. Now, whether that actually happens is another story, but it's all part of the glorious. Everybody in the Middle East has got a Vision 2030 plan, which is to turn their oil-rich country into a country rich in other things. Which is an interesting idea, and I suppose the best Western example that doesn't involve oil is Las Vegas. Let's build something in the middle of the desert, and people will come visit it, and they do. So maybe it'll work. Maybe, I don't know if the casinos are part of the attraction.
The
probably are, but I don't know. It's a bit like if you go to Dubai, for example. I mean, I find Dubai is great for the first 3 days. Then what do you do? Apart from look at sand. You know, so I don't know. I'm going to go and probably going to go and see the expo as well, because that's on. The Expo 2020 is still going in Dubai, because it didn't happen in 2020. And I've got two or three days between.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, I've got two or three tickets and you're invited. And I was like, just give me a minute. I'm going to pack my bags, Joe.
The tickets are cheap as chips. I was looking them up on the internet. They're giving them away. You just have to fly there. That's all.
Oh, okay.
But I went to the last expo in Milan, I think it was. And that was quite good. So I might go. It depends if too many crowds. I can't stand all those crowd things. Don't like them much. But
oh, I'm with you there, Joe.
They always build interesting things. They always build interesting things at expos, you know. And it, actually, if you look at the Formula One World Championship, every time we go to Montreal, we are, in fact, visiting the old expo buildings there.
All right. Can I ask some super dumb dumb? Oh.
There's strange pavilions. There's strange pavilions in the background that Formula One cars whistle past in Montreal, or in fact from the Expo of 1967.
Oh, you learn something every day. Just a quick admin note that I never mean to interrupt, Joe, but our signal has to get all the way through to the French countryside, down a lane, and then you have a personal guard at your gate that stops and checks the internet for ID. And that's why sometimes it can seem like we're talking over each other. So apologies for that. But can I ask some really basic questions about the Saudi Arabia track? So when they say they built it, is it built on an existing track, on public road? What's the basis?
I think that there were some public roads there, but I think what they did was basically bulldoze a lot and start again by the look of it. So I think it will probably be used for public roads later on, bits of it.
Right.
But it's on the Corniche, which is, you know, basically a bit of land next to the sea, and it whizzes up and down, and it looks really good. Okay. And we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. All right. So, because like Turkey with its new track and its weird new surface last year, it's completely unknown territory. Have you got any inkling of who it's going to suit, how it's going to drive?
It's fast, so it should suit the Mercedes right now.
Oh, I'm neutral, but yes, cool.
I think in terms of getting a decent world championship showdown, yeah, one more Mercedes victory would be very good.
I agree. A Hamilton victory would be good for the sport. That's why I'm hoping for that.
But you've just upset 20 million Dutchmen who are now jumping up and down and throwing orange things at the computer.
Joe, I've been doing that all season. It's fine. I'm pretty sure they've run out of oranges to throw at this particular turnip.
Do you know, just as just to give you an idea of the amount of support there is for Max Verstappen out there in the real world, I posted a photograph the other day on my Twitter feed.
I saw it.
Which chugs along at, you know, sort of sensible numbers. And 940,000 people looked at that photograph of Max Verstappen shaking the hand of a marshal, which left me completely speechless, because all I want them to do is just click on follow Joe and then I'll be rich, won't I?
Yeah.
You know, I can be a social, whatchamacallit-er.
If you got a dollar for each one of those views, that would be good. But we have noticed,
right,
we've been paying a lot of attention to the social media within our crew, and there is one member of our crew who perhaps isn't a Max Verstappen fan, it might be fair to say. Mm-hmm. And so he will post things like, Max Verstappen was wrong here. And he will get a huge amount of attention, of course, from Lewis Hamilton fans this season. So I wonder if there's a really partisan nature of it as well, Joe. And it's your neutrality that makes you tick along. You need to pick a side and go for it with as much toxicity as possible.
Yeah, well, I can't be bothered at all. I believe that journalists are supposed to be objective. And propagandists can support one side or the other. But I have to just chug along down the middle, and if somebody does something wrong, I'll say so. Mm. And that goes for everybody. No fear nor favor, you know, or something like that. Anyway.
But you get a lot of
abuse from one side or the other if you're in the middle. So, yeah, it's true.
Now, on a slightly sadder note, obviously we lost Frank Williams on Sunday, who passed away at the age of 79. We spoke a little about it and his legacy on the show on Sunday. But of course, you had a much more personal relationship and knowledge of Frank Williams. And even as a 41-year-old, see, I was saying to some of the newer fans to F1, if you drop into F1 now, you think of Williams as a backmarker team. When I was growing up, they were everything. They had champions. They almost were Formula One to me. Yet even as a 41-year-old, I didn't really know of Frank Williams like pre-accident, and I didn't see, you know, him in his full pomp, and so I'm missing out on that early story, the privateer success, the bringing it up from nothing, which I suppose you were much closer to.
Well, actually, I never knew Frank before the accident, to be honest. I was working in motorsport before he had his accident, but I didn't meet him until afterwards. So I don't know I met him about 3 years after the accident and got to know him pretty well. And I think it's an interesting, it's a weird thing to say, but I once had a conversation with Frank about success. And I said, is it fair to say that if you hadn't been in a wheelchair, you wouldn't have been as successful as you were?
Oh, okay.
And he said, yes, that's true, because there would have been diversions. I would have been diverted doing other things.
And so...
But because that's what he had, that's what he did. And, I mean, I don't think it would have been very different because he was always focused on Formula One like nothing else. But, you know, it was interesting to have that conversation with him. Because literally, you know, if you're a tetraplegic in a chair, there's not a lot you can do. And that's what Formula One kept him alive. And it kept him alive, you know, a long time. And he effectively dropped out of Formula One, I suppose, about sort of 6 or 7 years ago.
That recently, though?
But yeah.
So he went on actively for quite long.
Yeah, I mean, he was still in charge of the team in about 2011, 2012. But then his wife died of cancer, and that really, really hit him. Which is weird because Frank's was one of the toughest people you'll ever meet, and brutal sometimes. But based on his history, you know, he'd had a lot of tough things he had to deal with. So, but that really, really got to him, and then I suppose old age got to him too. And he was, you know, I noticed it. In about that sort of era, we'd start having the same conversations twice. And it was like, sort of, Frank, you just said that. And it was basically, he was, you know, it was the onset of dementia. And so he stepped down from the board and Claire took over, and Frank was the figurehead. But obviously he was kept in the background because he was, you know, they're never quite sure what he was going to do next, to be honest. And then in the last few years, he'd been very weak and old, and he's nearly died a couple of times already, actually. And so I wasn't hugely surprised when I got the phone call on Sunday. But you know, it's terribly sad. But you know, it's terribly sad in as much as 80-year-old for a tetraplegic man is doing pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, when Williams were having all that success in the 90s, for example, was Frank still a very active team principal at that point, even beyond his accident?
Oh, yeah. I mean, no. Frank was the one of the reasons that the team was not successful was that Frank wasn't there anymore. He was there in spirit, and he was there in, you know, he'd still wheel himself around the factory a little bit, and up until, obviously, when the team was sold, but the people were working for Frank, and you know, even if it was, I think that waned a little bit, particularly as some of Frank's people were sort of cleaned out as time went by. You know, people thought it was a better idea to get other people because they would be better, and obviously they weren't, because the team just went downhill. And it did have a sort of revival, but it, you know, with the Mercedes engines in 14. But it didn't last very long.
Yeah, it felt like a false storm.
I think the lesson in all this is that the reason the team was successful is it had a force behind it that was Frank, and that for a very charismatic man. It's hard if you ever saw him on TV or in an interview or listened to him. Frank, the minute you turned any recording instrument on, he went different, and so you never really got Frank because he was just. I don't know if he was paranoid about them or, you know, I just never used to turn the machines on, you know, and we just chat and get on with it. And it, hugely charismatic man. And you'll hear people like, I saw Mario Andretti saying, you know, when Frank came into a room, everyone knew he was there. And I always felt that about Mario, weirdly. You know, there are certain people who've got these auras about them. And Frank was one of them. And I don't know exactly what that means, whether it's in the mind of the viewer. Sometimes that may be the case. Or maybe it's just the innate confidence that successful people sometimes have. But there was a presence and a charisma about Frank, which was spectacular. And people followed him. you know. Mm. And it was based a little bit on endless years of failure. You know, this is one of the things about people think that coming to Formula One and you're jolly successful straight away. You're not. That's why Ron Dennis had Project 4.
Yeah.
That's why Frank Williams spent 10 years in pain. That's why actually Toto Wolff took quite a long time to get things going. Christian Horner, it took a long time to get Red Bull winning after he took over. But, you know, you need to have a force. Sometimes the force is the driver. Sometimes the force is the engineer. I'm Patrick Head also. You mustn't overlook the role that Patrick played in Williams. And the other thing is one should never overlook the role that Ginny Williams, Frank's wife, played in Williams, because she was a very important part of the whole chemical formula, if you like, that made it work. And yeah, in its day, it was a fantastic racing team. And it gradually slid. And Frank was always, you know, Frank would always say, if you say, well done, this is going really well, he goes, yes, but it might not next week.
Oh,
you know, and that was his, yeah, that was always his view, is, you know, so look out, it could go wrong.
Nothing for granted.
Well, he didn't really. Mm. And then in the gradual slide, and if you look at it too over time, because he started stepping back, I suppose, after the BMW years, and he had a couple of CEOs come in. And I think that was, you know, Adam Parr was one of them, and he did a very decent job to try and revive it. But he was a marked man from the beginning because he'd upset Bernie. So, you know, he was then axed out of the way. Toto came and went. And, you know, after that, Frank sort of ran out of ideas, I think, in terms of who should run it. So I think that him coming away from the coalface, if you like, is probably the key element in why the team wasn't successful anymore.
You spoke about that, those early interactions, and you talk about like someone not being in Bernie's favour. I've been reading, obviously, a lot of stories about Frank Williams' life, and I read one that was talking about him taking kind of personal loans from Bernie Eccleston. So Bernie's like literally helping Frank and Williams stay afloat and stay in F1.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things about Williams, is that Williams was, after Bernie sold Brabham, if Bernie had a racing team, it was always Williams that he sort of, you know, kept an eye on. And if, yeah, but by then Frank was very successful, yeah. But certainly in the early times, he helped Frank a lot. But Frank always paid, you know, Frank always paid his bills. There are a number of teams over the years that didn't, but Frank was always very, very, you know, he would, as you probably read the stories, he'd come in, he'd pay the debt, and then he'd say, "Can I borrow some more money?" And you know, that was Frank. And I remember, goodness me, when would that be? I guess it was about 2014 or 15 or so. Frank had this huge house in the country in Berkshire, which was a lovely house. And after Ginny died, he decided he was going to sell it. And it sold for some inordinate amount of money, you know, like sort of £30 million or something. And I spoke to him after that, and he said, "You know, this is the first time in my life, in my adult life, that I haven't been in debt."
How old was he then?
He would have been 60.
Oh, right.
Well, 70 odd. Yeah.
So that's how we cut about. Stuart in our live chat here is just asking, what did Parr do to upset Bernie?
He walked into the first meeting and said, "Why are the TV revenues about the same as Turkish football?"
Oh, instead of being lots. And what was the answer to that? Was it because Bernie made money in other ways?
There was no answer to that, because that was actually the truth. But It wasn't the right thing to say when you first meet Bernie Ecclestone. You know, that's the truth, is that football was at that point a bigger draw. So and lots of football leagues made more money than Formula One did at that point. They wasted it more too, probably. But the thing to do with Bernie was not to walk in and tell him, you know, it was just like Adam could have walked in with a pot of paint and just painted in target on himself. It would have been easier.
Would have got it over with quickly.
And in the fullness of time, you know, when the opportunity arose, a very sharp stiletto went sliding in between his ribs, and that was the end of him. So
So, I mean, I guess the way to leave that is just to ask about the legacy, really. I know Daralton is in charge and owns that Williams team. I would like it, as an F1 fan, I guess it's just nostalgia to have the name, even though it's not owned by the Williams family anymore. Or do you think it's inevitable that it is, we're going to, you know, lose that name? And like Janai, they're going to want to rebrand it as like Skoda or something, you know?
No, I don't think they'll rebrand it, because Williams is a brand in its own right that has enormous value that hasn't been properly exploited, by the way. Mm. I don't think you're going to throw away a brand like Williams. So I think what Daralton will do is they will do everything possible to take it back to being a winner and then exploit that commercially along the way. So that's the logical thing to do, as indeed Frank did. You know, if you look back, you'll find that Williams had, there were Renault road cars, which were Williams versions of the Renault road cars, you know, this sort of stuff. And, you know, Frank had deals going. Remember, don't forget that Williams won the British Touring Car Championship. And Williams also won Le Mans.
Oh.
And they also built the Metro 6R4 rally car.
How did that do?
Well, the Metro 6R4 rally car was an astonishing piece of kit. But unfortunately, the Group B rules were cancelled before it could really get going. Oh. But they know Williams did lots of things that people don't necessarily know about. In addition, and they had Williams Advanced Engineering as well, which did lots of really good stuff. But that's all there's so much for it was sold. However, I do have a certain amount of faith in the new crew.
You do.
And I think yes, I do. I think Daralton's got lots of money and they understand what they're doing. There's a man called James Matthews, who is in the middle of it all. And James is from a different dynasty of racing, if you like, because his father raced British touring cars, had one of the biggest shunts you'd ever imagine, Dave Matthews, back in the 70s. And James won the British Formula Renault Championship at one point. And he didn't have the money at that point to go on to be a racing driver. And so what he's doing now is living out, you know, his ambitions in racing, running Williams. And now, obviously, he's not running on a day-to-day basis. That's Jos Capito doing that. But, you know, the first thing Williams has to do is to get a manufacturer behind them. And when they've done that, then you can start talking about winning again. Now, I happen to think that Williams and Porsche will ultimately get together.
Ooh.
And I think that we could then see, you know, look, Lawrence Stroll can go in and tell his investors that his team will be a championship winning team within a few years. That's fine, but he's got to have his own engine. You do not win world championships as a customer engine. And anybody who leaps up and says, but hang on, what about Red Bull? The answer to that is that when Red Bull won their championships with Renault, Renault pulled out because of the embarrassment in Singapore. And Renault were no longer involved. So Red Bull was in effect the factory team until Renault came back. And when Renault came back with its own team, of course, that's when Red Bull and Renault fell out. So, which is why ultimately now Red Bull has to have its own engines, because it can't find anyone else it wants to work with. So everybody has to have their own engines to win world championships. So if McLaren are going to win another world championship, they need another engine. Mercedes have got one, they're fine. Ferrari have got one, they're fine. Renault have got one, they're fine. Red Bull have got one now, thanks to Honda. Whether they're fine or not, we'll see. But I think that using someone else's technology over a period of time, we saw Renault do that back in the 90s, and it sort of faded away with Supertechs and other engine things like that. Mm. But we'll have to see how they do. They fired lots of people, and the next generation engine may well be a very good engine, but only because they've got the infrastructure to do it. But if you're going to do it, you've got to have a manufacturer behind it or have your own engine. So
wait a minute. So you
Aston
think
Martin has to do it?
Yeah. So you think Porsche would build an engine like that? Just would enter
yes.
as an
engine? Yes, I do.
Isn't entering as an engine yes. manufacturer incredibly hard and futile now?
No, I don't think so. I think the last information that I have on this subject is that Porsche will come in as an engine manufacturer and Audi will try to buy McLaren. So
what?
Yeah, that's the word on the street. So, and Audi buying McLaren makes a lot of sense, to be honest. Because you can, I don't know if they want the road car business. The road car business would fit into the portfolio, but I'm told that BMW want the road car business.
Wow.
So, yeah, there you go. There's lots of things happening at the moment.
Hang on, we've got to unpick just a little bit of that. So I was just recovering from the Williams Porsche bomb, and I guess this is with the new engine regulations in 26 that are hopefully they all agreed to make it a little bit easier for an engine manufacturer to come in. And then I guess McLaren becomes Audi or McLaren Audi. What do you envisage?
Who knows? But there are very clear negotiations going on right now between McLaren and Audi over the future. And I think that Porsche is going to do something different because Porsche and Audi, although everyone says they're under the same Volkswagen banner, they're not. They are, but they're not. I need to explain that, don't I?
Yeah, please.
Volkswagen is a big company. Everyone's heard of it. And everyone, it's the one of the biggest car companies in the world. What not a lot of people know is that Volkswagen is actually controlled by a company called Porsche. It's not the other way around because the Porsche family company, the investment company, owns the majority of it owns more shares than anybody else in Volkswagen.
So if they're going to spend the money, they're going to want it to be Porsche, not Volkswagen.
Well, yeah. I think they want both because they are, you know, if you look at Porsche and Audi, they've done different programs against one another several times already, like at Le Mans, for example. They're doing it again soon in LMDH, whatever that is. So they can compete against each other.
Yeah.
And so I think we can see them both doing it. Whether they do it with the same engine or a different engine is an interesting point, but I think the technology may be shared, but I think not necessarily.
Right, I'm with you now. That took some following, by the way. So you could have McLaren and Williams essentially getting their engines from the same mother company, but they might be badged differently. So we could have
Just badged differently. They might be different.
Yeah, okay.
But the technology may be shared. If you see what I mean,
but two factories just to be fully economical about it. So we might have.
Yeah, but they've got them already.
Yeah,
these factories already exist. I mean, if you're Audi and you want to have a whole team, then you buy the McLaren factory. But Audi's motorsport facility—they've got more than most Formula One teams. They've got their own test tracks. Audi and Porsche—they both have test tracks in addition to all the necessary. So, we'll see how it goes. What they don't have necessarily is the level of F1 expertise that you find in England, which is always the same problem everywhere. Although some would argue that there's enough expertise around Stuttgart in Formula One not to have to worry too much.
It's interesting because you get so many engineers out of the big engineering colleges in the UK, and there's a lot of crossover. Basically, they either go to F1 for the glamour or they go into the defence industry. So there is that hot pot of engineers.
And then they get bored in the defence industry and go into Formula One afterwards.
Well, there you go.
But it happens all the time. If you look in the aerospace industry, if you look through the top engineers in Formula One today, a lot of them started out in industry, got bored designing winglets on 777s or whatever they did, and came to Formula One because you get the result every 10 days. It's more exciting.
I certainly wouldn't argue with you that the F1 is more exciting than the defence industry. No argument from here, boss. But look at that future F1. I've lost count now. You've essentially got five works teams in that scenario with five different.
But you should have more. No, you should have more than five. You should actually have. If you think about it. Excuse me. Oh, I forgot to press the button, didn't I?
Yes, Joseph.
if you think about it. You have car companies in Formula One. You have got Mercedes, Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, Aston Martin, McLaren.
Yeah.
Alpine. You've already got six car companies. And how many engine companies are there?
Four? Renault, well, there's Ferrari, Mercedes.
There's three and a half with Honda.
Yeah.
So you've got six car companies and four other teams. And fundamentally, each of those car companies, if they're serious about being in Formula One to win, as opposed to riding on the back of someone else's engines. I mean, Alfa Romeo Ferrari, or Aston Martin Mercedes, or McLaren Mercedes, to be honest, all of these things, they should have their own engines. And if they're cheap engines to be made, why not make them?
And they will
and
be
cheap. And it's a bit like Red Bull.
Yeah.
Well, they will be cheaper because there'll be a cost cap. And there'll be a price cap as well. So, and they will also be designed in such a way as to make spending money more difficult.
Making spending more money more difficult. So a good economical thing to do would be to have a bunch of customer teams filling the grid down the back, because then each engine is more cost productive.
That's true. But then again, the value as a branding exercise is less good.
Oh, I just want a 30-car grid. Why can't
I? I mean, if you're like Red Bull, you now have a Red Bull drink team, and you have a Red Bull fashion team. That works. You're in two businesses. Why not? I'm not quite sure where the engine program fits in, but that's really just to protect the two teams. Now, if you look at the others, customer team situation, Williams. Williams is a brand that isn't properly used, but it has lots of potential. So they don't build anything. I mean, they do build some stuff, but they don't have a particular product beyond racing, which means there's potential to have one.
I, as much as it's sort of sad to, quote unquote, lose the privateer spirit of McLaren and Williams, it is exciting if it just turns out into an out-and-out broad manufacturer war in F1 with lots of different teams, lots of engine suppliers. That makes me optimistic as a fan. I'm looking forward to that. No, I shouldn't be optimistic. Oh, we've
is
lost
that on or off? Oh, yeah. Up to a point, that's true, except that you have the traditional boom and bust cycle of motorsport, which is you have too many manufacturers. Some of them have to lose, therefore some of them leave. Mm. So it goes up and down. And the skill is to have as many staying in all the time as possible, which is Formula One has done very well in that, to have four who have stayed a long time. But now you've got three others that are riding on the coattails of manufacturers, and they're not really manufacturers. So, you know, they have to all figure out, because they're never going to win. I mean, if you think that a customer team is going to win a championship, you are dreaming. It's just not going to happen. Because, I mean, people say, well, what does it matter to the manufacturer? It matters a lot if they've got a team in there already, because they don't like being beaten by their customers. It makes them look like idiots, doesn't it? So you don't want that to happen. And if you look back in history, how many Ferrari-engined teams other than Ferrari have ever won races?
Is it not many? I can't think of a single. We had a Sauber on pole once, didn't we? And that was it.
Yeah. No. There was a Toro Rosso with Mr. Vettel driving, as I recall. That had a Ferrari engine, I think.
There we go. Monza.
And there was a car in 1961. There was a car that was ostensibly run by a semi-works team with Giancarlo Bighetti, who won a race. Won his first race, actually. But, you know, if you're a Ferrari customer, it means you're going to lose. So
yeah,
that's just the way it is. And Mercedes customers haven't won much either, apart from Daniel Ricciardo this year, of course.
Mm. Monza again. Maybe it's something about Monza, Joe.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I've got some listener questions for you, Joe, if you're up for it. What do you think?
Yes.
All right, let's see. Let's see where they're going. Jack Reeves says, Joe, do you think the bickering between Horner and Wolf has gone too far? It's getting a bit WWE, isn't it? I'm waiting for one of them to come in with a metal chair.
Sorry, I don't get the metal chair reference, but never mind.
The World Wide Wrestling Federation. No, Joe, I now have to explain to you all of WWF. No. You know, it's become... Okay, so wrestling is sports...
So they're hitting each other with chairs? Is that what you're saying?
Because it's sports entertainment. Okay. And for them, the result is fixed by the management. But you can't help but feel like... Damila Carley obviously loves Netflix, talks about it all the time. I just saw an article about a Netflix Drive to Survive Live element. So they're going to stream some stuff as well. And then they're deliberately putting Horner and Wolf in the same press conferences. And are we getting a little bit into staged drama?
No, I don't think so. I think there's some good old-fashioned distaste between the two of them.
Well, good.
which is based on competition. Fundamentally, they both want to win. And they both feel aggrieved that the other one has been unkind, I suppose. And I know that, as you can see from Toto's reaction when Lewis won in Brazil, that was, screw you lot, we've beaten you on the racetrack. And that was because I think he felt there was interference off the racetrack going on. Mm. And he didn't like it.
Was there?
And vice versa, yes, of course there was. Toto's not a fantasist, you know, he didn't make it up. But you know, that's what that whole business in Qatar was all about. The Verstappen right to protest thing was just it was just playing the game and basically diversionary tactics. If you are trying to beat somebody, the best way to beat them is to get their eye off the ball. So if you make something go bang on the left, when something goes bang on the left, I always look to the right. That's just an old habit I have. Because as a diversionary tactic is usually trying to hide something else. So, you know, that's what's going on at the moment. It's just anything you can do to try and beat the other people, take their eye off the ball, take some of their concentration away, then they'll do it because this is a very tight championship. And it is Formula One is total war.
If that's Horner's tactic, it didn't work very well. He's distracted them to the point that they absolutely thumped them in Brazil and Qatar.
Well, that's true. He also distracted himself by calling Marshall's silly names and stuff. So, you know, Christian's hasn't been playing awfully well of late. But, you know, he's up against a proper old school racing team. You know, Mercedes is a very, very hard operation to beat. And even if you're Max Verstappen, who's obviously an extremely talented driver, he's got to have the car to do it. But it's good to see that the drivers haven't been dragged into this too much. It was good to see on the podium in, I think it was in Brazil, to be honest, I can't remember which race it was, there have been so many recently, but Max and Lewis chinking champagne bottles on the podium. And it wasn't show, that was respect, mate, you know, you did the job. And it's a bit like, you know, when Fernando came up onto the podium and was chinking with Lewis and all this kind of stuff too, you know, these guys are... They should have respect for one another, and they do.
There's very little animosity, actually, personally, between Verstappen and Hamilton. Not publicly, anyway.
Why should there? Yeah. But why should there be? I mean, there's occasional... Those two incidents earlier in the year, one was predominantly Lewis's fault, one was predominantly Max's fault. That's what the stewards said. I tend to agree with them from what I saw. And there's a level of which both drivers felt the other one was being a bit naughty. But... this is, as Lewis and Max have both said, this is a world championship fight. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be nice about it necessarily. Your elbows are going to be out. So long as you are respectful up to a point That's the important bit. But I think that, you know, both of them want to be clean. Nobody wants to win a world championship by driving dirty, because you don't win. At the end of the day, there's annoying people like me who will always say, well, of course, he won that by doing this. And, you know, the classic example of that would be Michael Schumacher and his 94. Various adventures, where, as far as I'm concerned, Michael Schumacher never deserves to be treated as the world champion of 1994, because he played unfairly. And that's why when you read all-time great assessments by learned journalists, you rarely see Michael in the top two or three, even if his numbers say that he is the best,
yeah,
or was the best until Lewis beat him or
matched him,
equaled him, at least beaten him in race wins. But you know, it's how you do it is just as important about what you achieve. And I don't think that they understood that necessarily back in the 90s in the same way that it's understood today.
So good to see those two kind of not making it personal. Personally, I like that. The team principals are making it personal. Everything Horner says is like, oh, well, if that's what Toto thinks, blah, blah, blah. With the protests, Toto Wolff said something about there was a gentleman's agreement that they didn't protest certain things, and he felt that Christian Horner had broke it, and that now they were going to protest everything. Is that a real thing? Does that make sense? Is there like a protocol with the team principals of when and what they protest?
You can only have a gentleman's agreement when you have two gentlemen.
Okay. And that's all we've got time for. This one day.
No, but it's true. If somebody breaks a gentleman's agreement, they're no longer a gentleman. So that's just how it is. You know, it's really very simple. I mean, it's a question of honor more than anything else. And some people value winning more than they value their honor. But at the end of the day, when they get old and gray, they'll be able to look back and think, well, I didn't really win that one fairly. You know, some of them won't, because people have an amazing ability to delude themselves.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. Just delude yourself.
You can go through a whole of life deluding yourself, but in the dark moments, when you stop to think about it, you'll say, yes, but I was cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll know it. Even if you don't admit it to yourself, you're you'll
only
still
cheating
know it.
Yourself.
And that's why.
Yeah.
Exactly. Cheats only cheat themselves. And that is fundamentally why, one of the reasons I think there's been less cheating in Formula One over the years in the modern era, because people understand that now.
Okay. A couple more questions then, just around in and around this topic. Miguel is asking, what does Joe think about the Mercedes rear wing? Is it potentially illegal or Red Bull playing games? We sort of covered that. I think...
It's very simple. If it passes the tests, it's legal.
Mm.
Even if it's not in the spirit of the regulations, you know, the history of Formula One is dotted with people who found ways to make the car pass a test and then make it different on the racetrack. There's nothing illegal about that until the FIA changes it and you don't pass the test.
Okay. I think that's just clever.
It's just clever. Now, there's a difference between a grey area and outright cheating. And that difference is, we've seen a few of those over the years, but we won't go into too much detail about that, because people get very upset if you say they were cheating. But a grey area is a grey area, and a cheat is a cheat.
Okay, let's go to some more questions then. Steve, the Brofit, says, have you got any wild speculation or inside track about which team might have found a magic bullet for next season, like a double diffuser from Braun? Any sniffs?
No, there's nothing at the moment.
Sorry, Steve.
Everybody's positive about next year, because you would be. But the smart people are all saying, yeah, but everyone's positive. So it's not a good idea to be too positive, because we have to... It's not how you're doing within your own empire that's important. It's how you're doing in relation to the others. And we don't know that until the cars are put on the track against one another. So they've all got their targets, and they're all hitting their targets, surpassing their targets. But are their targets the right level?
You know, I will make the very boring prediction that the people who are really good at making race cars in this last era will also be really good at it next season as well.
And I think they will be better than they are this year, because new formulas generally tend to spread out the field and not draw it closer together. No, it doesn't mean it's going to be a disaster. I'm just saying that it tends to, you know, if you leave a formula the same for a long time, everyone closes up because knowledge is gathered, expertise, clever little tweaks. Everyone does all the things, they learn all the stuff, and everyone ends up quite close together. But, you know, copying doesn't always work best. For example, look at Aston Martin this year. What a disaster that is compared to Racing Point last year. Now, why that is, I can't explain it, really, because they shouldn't be that far back. Because given what they were, I mean, they won a race this time last year. Well, they won a race because Sergio Perez wouldn't be in a Mercedes if they hadn't. You know?
Red Bull, so, yeah. Yes.
Sorry, yes. 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 Let's try and get that one right, shall we? Yeah, Sergio, if he hadn't won the Bahrain or whichever Grand Prix it was, I can't remember which one was which now, but if he hadn't won that race, actually, I think he won Sakhir, didn't he?
Yes. From the back.
If he hadn't won that, he wouldn't have had the Red Bull drive today. But he was, you know, he would have been out of Formula One, which is kind of ironic, isn't it? But to go back to the point, you know, last year Racing Point was a winning force. Okay, somebody had to stumble for it to happen, but it happened. This year, that you wouldn't even dream of them getting close to winning anything. So why is that? Technically, everything's supposed to have been frozen as well, to some extent. Is it to do with leadership, perhaps, as I was discussing with Frank? You know, you've got to have somebody who you believe in. I don't know. Maybe it's that.
So, I mean, a little while ago, what we were hearing was that Otmar Schaffner was basically came up with the statement saying that Lance Stroll was one of the most talented raw talents in Formula One, and everyone kind of went, "Hey, what's he up to?" And then we heard that was kind of a last-ditch effort to reconcile his relationship with Papa Stroll, and strongly rumoured to be on his way out now. So that doesn't speak to the leadership very well, does it?
Well, I think that's middle management in that particular case.
I see.
The leadership is who owns the racing team. And I don't know, we'll see how it goes. But fundamentally, I just want to say, you know, there was a famous scandal in Britain, the Profumo scandal, and a girl called Mandy Rice Davis. And when somebody said, you know, this is what this other book did, she said, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? And that's what I would respond to with Otmar praising Lance to the hills. I mean, Lance has a lot of abilities, but he's not the full package.
No, and he's not one and of the greatest tries, more talents. Yeah. Sorry.
Every so often he does things you think, where did that come from? But that's not enough. You know, you've got to have that and more. And so I think that anybody who is deluding themselves that this is the case, I mean, maybe he'll develop. You also have to add that. But he has had quite a lot of years in Formula One already. So I think you just have to, if you're the father of a racing driver, you have to be very sanguine about the realities. I don't think you can believe the dream for too long. It works against you if you believe the dream. And you have to believe the reality. And that's, I think, something that Aston Martin has to work their way through. Or Lance has to just, you know, develop to such an extent that everyone goes, wow, yeah, Dad was right.
Yep, it might happen.
Yeah.
Shall we go from one billionaire?
Then again, it might not.
It might not. Shall we go from one billionaire to another? Because the next question is also billionaire related from Shushan on Twitter. Is there any serious talk about Mazepin getting out of the light? Is there any difference in light of Mazepin having a big difference between himself and, this is what they're saying, the rest of the drivers? Is there any prospect of him just leaving F1 and going, well, I'm not up to standard, because he doesn't seem to be.
I don't think that's fair. Yes, he's been off. Not always, but he hasn't always matched Mick Schumacher's pace. There are lots of different reasons for that. one of which is Mick has been much better than people thought he was going to be. Mick's also got a lot more experience than Mazepin has. And there's a level of which also some of the tracks Mazepin's never been to, which Mick has been to. And then if you start analysing the mistakes, you'll find that Mick and Mazepin have made almost the same number of mistakes. In fact, I'm not even sure that Mick isn't ahead at the moment. But why would he give up? Well, he'd give up if he doesn't want to do it anymore, but he obviously does like doing it. So why is he going to stop? He's not. Are the team going to stop? No, they're not. So no, it's not going to stop.
Okay. Can I just argue one point there, though? You know, you're saying that...
You can argue as much as you like.
Mazepin has less experience and hasn't been to these tracks. Well, I mean, whose fault is that? Shouldn't he have just spent more time getting more experience and going to more tracks and doing more racing?
Maybe. Maybe he should, but, you know, that's the way of the world. You know, if you look at if you look behind what you see, i.e. not just the race meetings, people go testing in old cars in lots of places. And Mick's had a very, very good grounding in that respect. Mazepin has had some of that too. Guanyu Zhou has had a lot of that. And we'll see that when he appears next year. Because he's been out testing Renault Formula One cars, all kinds of places, very quietly in the background, old ones. You know, you're allowed to do that. And there are other programs going on. Porsche will be doing much the same kind of thing, I'm sure. In fact, to be prepared for Formula One in the modern era, you need to do that, because otherwise you just get thrown in at the deep end and you're going to get beaten. So I think Mazepin has been a little bit disappointing this year. I thought he would be doing better by now. But I don't think he's been an embarrassment. I do think he has natural speed. Does he have the same natural speed as the greatest drivers around? No, probably not. But he does have speed. And, you know, you can't knock that. He doesn't necessarily have the same racecraft. He's not perhaps he's not as skilled at setup. Perhaps he's not as focused on the task as Mick. I think he probably is.
But, you know. I think you've been very generous there. But what we've said is, apart from raw speed, racecraft, setup, desire, hunger, attitude, approach, we've named like all the things that make you a good race driver there, surely. Isn't there just a point where we just say...
No, natural talent is also part of it, isn't it? Yeah, what I'm saying, it's the same with Stroll or with Latifi as well, another example. they've all got elements of what they need. But they haven't all necessarily got all the elements of what they need. Now, Mick has been impressive because he seems to be doing a better job with what he has. I don't think that Mick is necessarily the fastest race driver in the world. You know, I just don't think he is. But he's done a very good job with all the other elements. So this is, you know, you have to judge drivers on their results. And if you judge their drivers on the results, Mazepin has been a disappointment compared to Mick, which is the only comparison you have. But there are reasons why that may have been the case, which I've explained some of them. And we'll see next year, I think that's a good way of putting it. We'll see next year if Nikita has learned the lessons of this year and if he can be equal to or beating Mick next year. We'll see.
Okay.
But. You know, I don't think he's embarrassing.
Okay. Rob has made a comment here in our chat room. Mazepin has a good few million elements of what a modern F1 driver needs. Comment of the week. And sorry, Joe.
Yeah, but you can say the same about Mick.
Yes.
You can say the same about Latifi. You can say the same about Stroll. You can say the same about almost everybody, because there's nobody in Formula One who comes from a... Well, I'll say that again. There are some people in Formula One who come from poor backgrounds, but they were picked up by rich people.
You need backing
sponsors
early.
Along the way. Yeah. You need backing early on, and you need a lot of backing. And there's a lot of people in Formula One who are richer than you think as well. Their daddies are quite rich.
Like, you don't think of Norris as being a rich billionaire pay driver, but he's incredibly rich.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is true. And you don't think necessarily of... as George having huge amounts of money behind him, but there was enough, you know, and otherwise he wouldn't be there, you know.
Fair enough.
All these people, either, unless you have a Red Bull behind you, and then, you know, you have different problems then. But if you have a Red Bull or a Mercedes looking after your costs, then you can do stuff. But, you know, nobody is really struggling up the greasy pole with no money. Yeah. I mean, you know, I suppose you could say Dan Ticktum, but he's been struggling down the greasy pole more than anything. But
no comment. can I end on one joke?
You don't have to have a comment. You don't have to have a comment. I'm sure that Dan's got one out there waiting.
I'm sure. I'm wary of the time for you, Joe. Just one last listener question, because it's pertinent, I think, to the championship. And I'm so nervous and excited for the next two races coming up. Anything goes wrong for either team, and that's it, pretty much done. I know only Max can win it this weekend, but if Max has a DNF and Hamilton gets 28 points, you know, that's all but done, barring, you know, they're relying on away goals and miracles by then. Is it true, asks Bobby, is it true that Honda wanted Max to take a new engine in Qatar, but Red Bull went against it? Because here's my thinking. If they take a new engine here in Saudi Arabia, then they have more power for the final. If they just concede this next race almost, is that a smart move? And is that true, what Bobby said? Did Honda want Max to take a new engine?
I don't know the answer to that first one, because it wasn't something that passed beneath my eyes. And whether or not it's a good thing, you know, the engine management is an important element in the championship, because when you get a new engine, you do get a better performance, generally speaking. But then it's a matter of how fast they tail off and stuff like this, because they do tail off. And, you know, a tired engine is a tired engine. I know that's kind of a bizarre thing to say about lumps of metal, but, you know, they do grow weary when they're getting up towards the end of their life. So, yeah, if a driver has the thing is, you don't want to be taking penalties this late in the year, because particularly at tracks where either you don't know if you can overtake or, you know, you can't overtake. It's really not a good idea to be taking those kind of penalties. So I think probably in a theoretical world, we're probably finished with the engine strategies, but we may not be.
Interesting.
I don't know for certain, but it, you know, the penalty of having to start back down on the grid is a serious penalty. And that's what actually was most remarkable about Lewis in Brazil, is he just got on with it and did it from the very back.
Yeah, it was impressive. Joe.
That was one of the best drives I've seen in 600 Grand Prix. So
599. Right up there. Let's not jump the gun.
No. Well, that's an interesting point. I've been having this argument actually with somebody. Have I already done 600 Grand Prix? Because I went to Australia and paid for it, and that doesn't count. But I also went to Belgium. Does that count? Because fired up the engines in Belgium.
There was a result.
Did they go racing?
Yeah, there was points. So I mean, from your point of view, that counts. So you've already...
I agree with you. That's true. But so I've been to 600 races, but there were only 599 actually run.
I don't know. I think that counts. Joe, let me be the first to congratulate you on 600 Grand Prix as a journalist. It's an amazing run, actually, an amazing career.
Not really. There's quite a few with 600 Grand Prix, but there aren't many who've done it consecutive races without missing one.
Nice.
In fact, there's nobody who's done one.
And you still haven't missed close. One. You still haven't missed one.
I haven't missed one since the Spanish Grand Prix of 88.
Okay. There. It's not a bad run. When do you leave?
Which is like 589 or something. I don't know.
Oh, Joe, you're going to have to move closer so we don't get this lag. I'm sorry. I know France seems nice, but you're just going to have to move to perhaps Aylesbury or something like that, just so we're less lag on the old internet. But you're heading off to Saudi Arabia. When do you leave?
Tomorrow morning.
Okay. And then that's you.
Tomorrow morning being Wednesday morning. So I will get into Saudi on Thursday morning. But as things don't start on Thursday till very late in the day, because I think probably the press conferences will, but to be honest, I'm not that interested in those. But track action is all starting in the evening, so everyone's going to be leading strange lives, upside down lives.
Is the race sort of Singapore traditions. Is it? It's not a nice night race, is it? It is a night race.
Which one?
the Saudi Arabia.
Yes, Saudi is a night race, yes.
Wow, so they've got floodlights.
I think it's an 8 o'clock start or something like that.
So in the UK, I believe the race starts at 5:30. Half five. Yeah, it's 5:30, I think, in the UK, the TV times are listed at. I don't want to throw
I don't know what the TV times are, but all I know is it's an evening race, and we've got to take into account the time zones, which I guess in Saudi is 2 hours, 3 hours. I don't know.
Let's do a public service for GMT and say that qualifying is 5 p.m. on the 4th, and the race is 17:30, so 5:30 p.m. GMT. That's an odd start time, but there we go. Joe, let's get people to...
No, that must be the programming, not the actual race start.
Perhaps. All right. Sorry, I've muddied the waters. Joe, safe travels is what the chat room is saying. And let's send people over to where they can find you, at Joe Saywood on Twitter, where you will now be a one-sided shock jock type tweeter to raise, now that you've had a taste of that viral photo.
Yeah. Yeah, all I'm going to have my lips done too.
So. Yeah, hot takes, all hot takes, all the time.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. I have no idea what that is. So.
Search for Joe Saywood on the internet, and it is the first search term that comes up. You've got your blog, you've got your green notebook, and GP Plus magazine to go and subscribe to.
Yeah, if you actually want to see all the range of things, you can go to flatoutpublishing.com, where everything is linked together there, and you can whiz off and buy books and buy subscriptions and buy everything.
Yeah,
yes.
Buy stuff. And you can also follow me on the internet too, at Spanners Ready or Richard Ready on Facebook. Come and follow me. My DMs are open. Let's be friends. Until our Saudi Arabia race review, all I'd ask is that you work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast with Joe and Spanners and sometimes the right music. Yeah, I think it is 5:30, you know. 5:30 p.m., Joe.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.